Thank you, everyone. Thank you for sticking around, and thank you for Kent for setting the stage for me, because he's really sort of made half my presentation. I thought we'd sort of start off and just take a little look at what we're talking about here. And I am going to concentrate mostly on haulers. I'm not going to talk about shovels this time. But one thing that Ken said is absolutely true. It's literally the quality of the haul road and how that interacts with the hauler and how these two work very much together. So given that they're basically working in tandem, we should be able to pull information off the hauler, and we can pull information off the hauler to tell us about what else is going on with the entire system. And that is not just the ride quality, it's about the tires, it's about the road itself, it's about the frame, it's about the suspension. And ultimately, you could go all the way up to the operator, and I've talked about that a couple of years ago. So essentially, what I do and what I've been doing for almost 30 years now is doing analysis of systems, and in particular in the last 20 years is looking at haulers and shovels, particularly around what we can find out about that machine, take its pulse, beyond what the system that's on board already. So whether it's VIMS, whether it's Comtrax, it doesn't matter whose system it is. But essentially, there's a lot more to this. And there's a lot more that Caterpillar could do. There's a lot more that Komatsu could do. There's a lot more that the other vendors could do with their systems. It's just, where do you stop? There literally is a wealth of information that can be pulled out of the same data. And that's what we're going to take a little look at today. And so essentially, I'm not going to confuse people with engineering. I'm just going to say, this is stuff you can do today with the data you have today. You don't need to add things onto your machines. You don't need me. You just need to be able to put some of this into action. And that's really what I do in the courses I give and some of the other stuff, is basically training people to look after themselves, to be able to do without people like myself. One guy you can't do without, and if you're really having issues with haul roads, you need to call Roger Thompson. And Roger was here, let's see, Steve, it would be two haulages ago, so it would be 2011. And he talked about using resilient modulus as opposed to CBR. If you're out there managing your haul roads, designing your haul roads using the CBR method, you need to look again. Because the resilient modulus will tell you exactly what's going in terms of the deterioration rate of the haul road, not just the status when you take a snapshot. And that's the extra knowledge that we should be working towards as a benchmark. So this is where I start. And this is the data that if you have haulers operating, if you're an OEM, you know this data. This is your pressure data off your four suspension struts. This is the data you already have. There's nothing unusual here. You know what the actual charge is when you actually pre-charge those cylinders. The rears and the fronts have a specific charge, or literally, in the shop, you're going to charge it until you see so much stroke occur or reappear on your strut, and that's how you're recharging your struts. And that literally is the base, as if it was sitting still on level ground, empty, flat conditions, and they should match up more or less to your empty condition, which is literally that lower level of lines at the bottom. When we look closer at that data, it's the same data. But what I've done here is I've counted how many events do we get over a certain level. So the left-hand axis is always the number of events within a series of duty cycles. And this was an 8-hour shift on a particular hauler. And on the bottom is our pressures. So you can see for the unloaded condition, all four cylinders are basically centered around 3,000 kPa. That's where they're sitting. So roughly around, what's that? It's about 450 PSI. That's where they're sitting when they're unloaded. They're sitting in that type of position. Okay? They're literally centered around that. There's a little bit of variation depending on how they're seated on the ground. Once they start moving, things start to change. So we can see the front cylinders go up to about 7,000 kPa, and the rear cylinders go up to around 11,000, but look at the variation. And what I really wanted to show here, here's this laser. Look at the range. So there are events up here that are getting up to 16 to 19,000 kPa. Those are huge pressure numbers. These are the events that I worry about, that Kent worries about, that everyone else worries about when we come to worry about the actual structural life of that truck. These are the ones that are causing such a damaging event on that frame, it's going to be irreversible. However, every one of those experiences is causing an event on that frame. And so the actual true life of a frame is the area that's under the curve. This represents the number times the magnitude, just like doing a fatigue calculation. All fatigue is the number of events you actually incur, how many times you hit, and how hard you hit each time. You add them all together, that is the life experience of that frame at each one of those suspension points. So we could look at this and get an idea of what's going on. We can do exactly the same thing for what's actually sitting under each suspension, the tires, the ground, and so we can actually understand what's going on by just looking at the suspension on the truck to figure out a whole bunch of other things. This is the suspension itself. This here is just a little bit of thermodynamics. Suspension cylinders, if they're oleopneumatic, oil, nitrogen gas, or whatever else we're using, we could be using Neocon X and helium if we were Hitachi units. But essentially, this thing will hold constant, and you can figure out what your suspension cylinder is doing at any instant in time in terms of the available stroke. Well, if we plot up the same data as we did before, it really looks a mess. But if you then start doing the same analysis, counting the number of events and how big, you suddenly realize between the limit, so this is the peak, we're running at about 4.5 inches of strut deformation. We know the strut can go up to 6.5 inches for a rear cylinder on this particular unit. There's 1.5 inches of available stroke left. When it hits those high numbers, that is that much. That's all of this available. This is a 400-ton hauler, and that's all available on the stroke left to go. It's no wonder you literally have fluid so compressed, it's like hitting your head against a brick wall. It's not going anywhere. It's almost like steel on steel, even though there's a little bit of fluid there. The pressures are really, really high. For the front suspension cylinders, basically we have a mean of somewhere around 5 inches of deformation. The top end around 8, we've got 6 inches of available stroke. That's still quite a bit. So the front end cylinders work very well. The rear cylinders, we know they don't move very much. You follow a hauler up a ramp, do you ever see that thing move? Can you actually see any clear steel on a loaded haul truck? No, it's absolutely dirty because it's completely closed up like a wooden chair. If I look at the tires, we can do a similar thing. Well, a tire essentially is an elastic unit. For the range in which we want to see it deform, it's behaving elastically. The sidewalls behave elastically. The actual crown of the tire, the spread of the tire is behaving elastically at different rates because of the belting and the shape. But essentially, if we look at an overall system for a 5980R63, I would say we're somewhere around 3850 kilonewtons per meter in terms of tire stiffness. And we can work out what those deformations are. So in tire deformations, if I'm looking at literally the actual deformations that occur between loaded and unloaded, we're looking at literally from the mean to the actual peak, plus or minus 4 inches in tire deformation on the rear tire positions, but it's also plus or minus 4 inches of tire deformation on the front. Well, that should be no surprise, because when we're fully loaded, we should have 1/6 of the load on each tire. It should be in balance. So that should be no surprise. What's very interesting is when we start to look at the actual tire flexure in terms of deformation, and this experience is just a sum of all those events, as we talked about before, times the deformation, so the areas under the curve. This is the rear struts unloaded. We're basically seeing about 1 inch of tire deformation. Here is the rear struts loaded for one particular rear. This is the right rear side, about 6 inches, a little bit higher for the left rear for this particular truck under loads going through this mine. The front, 4 inches unloaded, a little bit of variation on the front, and this may be carry back, this may be not quite the right tire pressure, there could be other things going on with these haulers, but this is just looking at that suspension data, nothing else. And then the front tire's loaded, look how much extra is there. Even though we think we've got 1/6 of the load on each tire, the front tires, because they have to steer, because they're flexing more, you're seeing that much more deformation on the front tires. That has to lead to reduced tire life. That has to lead to higher TKPH numbers. If I look at TKPH, we all know about the conventional calculation, and I think it was about 2 haulages ago I talked about measuring real-time TKPH. This is what it looks like as a distribution. Left front, left rear, right front, right rear tires. These are the mean values from these numbers here, but this is the distribution. For this particular tire model, we're somewhere around 2,000 to 2,200 TKPH is where the manufacturer says you should not exceed this number. This would worry me. If this is consistent on an 8-hour shift, I'm consistently seeing this 5 to 10% of all events, maybe even up to 12% of all events, are higher than the recommended TKPH value, even though the mean is still there below what's recommended. I'd be worried about this. This is taking life out of the tires. And again, the calculation is basically the number of events times the vehicle speed in kilometers per hour, literally by the mass above each suspension cylinder, so it's represented above that tire, G, and then A. This is the killer. This is the increment or decrement on G. This is what's giving you the extra push or rise. Think about dropping in an elevator and you feel like your stomach comes up to your heart, or you go suddenly up in the elevator. That's what the tire is feeling, but so much more. This number here could be like a 2 to 3 G event in most mining situations in hard rock mining. In oil sands mining, I've measured this at 4 Gs. That is halfway to a space shuttle taking off. It seems ridiculous, but you can measure those G levels that tell you those loadings on those tires are way beyond expectation. If I look at this a little further, so this is another set of tires from different model. This is 53 through 5980s, 63 rims. We're looking at basically heat resistant, and we're looking at that range of about 18 to 2200, 2250. For that same set of tires, it really is impacted by the quality of the road. And this is what Kent was talking about earlier. This is rolling resistance. If this is the limit, it's telling you your rolling resistance overall. This is your rolling resistance, not your total resistance, just your rolling resistance. Your rolling resistance should not exceed 9%. And you guys are saying, well, when does it exceed 9%? Well, if I told you in the oil sand, I measure rolling resistance at 24%. Now, Kent said the total effective grade should be more than about 12 to 13%. But when we've got 24% in the oil sands, you're kind of batting against zero. You've got nowhere to go. So hopefully you can try to do something about the quality of the roads and bring this down. But look what happens. You bring the rolling resistance down by a couple of percent, you can drop your TKPH values by 500. That's the reality of what you can do in terms of quality of haul road to influence the performance and the ability of a truck to keep going. Let's look at the ground itself. This is actually a pressure stiffness. It's different than just a regular stiffness. This is literally pressure per unit deformation. So it's the pressure off the footprint of the tire. So whatever shape that tire makes in terms of that area of contact with the ground and the amount of deformation you get, that is literally measuring a pressure stiffness. It's like doing a plate test, but with a flexible plate. And this is literally what we've been doing over the last few years in the field to try and validate some of these things. So essentially here, we have the mean condition for the loaded trucks showing me somewhere around 2 inches of deformation up to about 3.5 per cycle. This is per cycle. So imagine a ground continually deforming. This is per cycle. So there's literally about 3 inches there for both the front and the rear tires under the loaded condition. Again, because we're expecting 1/6 load per tire, that should not be any surprise, and the footprint areas should be roughly the same. This is what it looks like when we look at all the events that occur by deformation. So here, for example, these are the front. The yellow and green are front, the blue and the red are rear. The unloaded events and the loaded events. And what you'll notice here is the ground distributions are very similar to the tire distributions. And they should be, because the tire's loading the ground. And whatever the tire cannot absorb in terms of deformation, the ground is going to pick up. And in this particular assumption here, I used a constant stiffness for the ground. Now, stiffness isn't constant, but it gets more variable. But generally, the shapes are more or less the same. If I look at doing a haul road performance test, you run a number of different runs up and down the haul road doing a rolling resistance test. The first three seem to be peaked around here, and then suddenly it changes. Well, what changes is you got compaction. the road compacted more than you constructed it. Because remember, footprint area of your tires is that much smaller than the roller compactors you're using in the road. So you're going to indent it more, you're going to compact it more. Eventually it settles down a little bit lower. And this is a reasonably good haul road, we've got a couple of percent. If I look at the rolling resistance to the ground deformation, there's actually a calibration. This would be different for each material you have constructing your haul road. For me, this is just looking at in-pit oil sand, okay, covered with pit run and maybe a layer of limestone crush, just to give you a good quality haul road coming out. And this gives me a running surface calibration, and you can tell instantly the amount of deformation in the ground is directly proportional to rolling resistance, just like Kent said. The amount you indent, the higher the rolling resistance. If I look at a typical haul road from pit through to dump and back unloaded haul, you start looking at the number of events that occur, and I put this on a log scale because we get into the 10,000s of events for a loaded run. So the green is a loaded run, the blue is an unloaded run, but what you're seeing is, depending on how well the truck is loaded and where it is, it's going to have different effects. So you get different distributions. So for the loaded run, oh, got to go back one here. For the loaded run, we're seeing ourselves into the thousands of events with about 0.01 meters, so this is about 1 centimeter deformation per cycle. But imagine multiplying that by thousands of cycles. We're starting to get lots of deformation. And then here is the pit area, and you'll notice it starts to move up. So there's actually more deformation for the pit areas, for the dump areas, and that's to be expected because, as Kent said before, we're actually moving into considering how do we extend out that dump to become the next set of haul roads. This is an oil sand surface in terms of its rolling resistance, number of events. This difference here between the unloaded return and the loaded state, this is the impact of large payloads. When we had 170-ton trucks, we never saw this. This is the advent of the ultra-class truck. This is what we're now living with. The larger the hauler, the heavier the loads, the more deformation we're getting. So if you think about the pressures the tires on the 170-ton trucks used to put down versus the pressure on the tires putting down onto the ground from a 400-ton truck, it is that much higher. And that's what's causing these deformations. Down here, this is literally the pit dump area. It's not that there is peak events. There are peak events here. They just could be all over the place. It's huge variability because we're not constructing roads in pits and in dumps. If we constructed roads in pits and dumps, we would see a very defined shape. But this is from field data. I can't find a trend because there isn't one. There is no constructed road in that area. This is a typical pit to inbound road system. Traveling from about a 5 kilometer distance overall. This is what we can do with some of that information. What I've done here is I've taken the rolling resistance and I've matched up to what Roger Thompson does in designing haul roads. An 8% rolling resistance on a road that he would qualify at 1750 microstrain, that's his design for a 5 to 10 year haul road, you can expect to have a haul road last about 3 years. You drop down to 4%, you get an extra year. Isn't that worth knowing, that you could actually get more life out of your road with less maintenance if you're able to control your rolling resistance? Because now you're controlling all the extra support equipment that's going to be adding value. And to that point, if I look at grader operations, this is for a 24H grader, just a simple sample set of data I pull from the field. 24M grader, if I have literally the 1750, so the Roger Thompson design haul road, I'm looking to aim for about 1 hour of grading per kilometer on that haul road, regardless of how many graders you need, right? If I go up to about 2,800 microstrain, this is almost adding, it's almost doubling, not quite, but almost doubling, we're up to about 1.4 hours. And this is typical of haul road grading. This is what it looks like in pit and on dump areas. So in pit road grading, We're now literally gone from 1 hour, we're up to about 2.8 hours. Imagine that per kilometer for your entire road system, day in, day out, and then think about what Kent said about the cost. It just went through the roof. It just went out of whack so far, it's impossible to fathom how do we get back from that situation. Grading requirements by surface, these are capping surfaces that I have tested and tried out, including Claycrete, and I did this with Suncor last year or year before. So when we're looking at these situations, this is literally how much grading we can achieve per hour. So in limestone cap surfaces, we can get over about a kilometer per hour. In Claycrete, just below a kilometer. For pit run, just on oil sand, we're down to about 0.7 kilometers per hour. If you're actually on a sand cap or a sand surface, you never stop grading. There is no numbers, it just goes on forever. You can never take the grader off the road. Relative movement of the frame. So let's talk about the structural side. So the structural performance, we can go back to that raw data and we can see the difference between the deformation that occurs for the unloaded condition and the deformation that occurs for the loaded condition. And you can see that the rear locations were around 8 inches and the front locations around 4 inches. The rear suspension, if it's only 6.5 inches stroke, the frame is deforming more than the suspension is long. It's capable of actually moving. That's a huge hit. That's where you get the 2 to 3 to 4G events. That's what's happening when you cause a frame, a stiff frame, or effectively a stiff frame with some torsion tube to basically move that much. So here we have that same set of data. Here's the rear strut deformation, just less than 2 inches. The front, around 5.5 inches. Remember, these are key locations. It is stiffer at the back. It won't move as much. But you know what I'm saying? This kind of movement at the rear is a huge amount of movement for a stiff section of the frame. The front near the horse collar can move. It can torsion, it can twist, but it's doing it again. It's huge numbers. This star, I threw this in because when I ran this data the other day to throw it into the presentation, I didn't expect to see this. This scares the hell out of me. This is one set of conditions, which is both loaded and unloaded conditions going on. This one here, something happened on that frame. This frame probably has a crack because now it's flexing beyond it should be. This is a crack developing. When you see little peaks appearing outside of the normal course of a distribution, something's happening, and in this situation, that is a crack. Fatigue, well, we know that we cycle back and forth, plus or minus 6 inches in twist on a frame. If we look at a rack motion, so that's the four suspension cylinders, kitty corner sums, subtracted from each other. And we're seeing a plus or minus 6 inches in twist. We're getting 60 events over that 6 inches in 8 hours. Question is, should we worry about that? And it's hard to judge what that really means. What this means is if we look at the area under the curve as we've been talking about all through this presentation, if you're greater than 6 inches, that's where those numbers are. We saw that 6 inches. Here's the other 6 inches at minus 6 inches. But look at this life experience. It's not so much these little ones, it's this whole life experience added together. So it's a weighted distribution. A weighted distribution tells you all those small events are reducing the life of that frame. If I look at an example, this is a truck I ran for one of the oil sand companies on an 8.5% rolling resistance. Here's the accumulated life of the frame and loss in terms of rack events. And what I did was I added all the plus and minus events together and I just made them all positive values. This is literally the experience of that frame underneath that curve. And if I compare that to a frame that's running under good 1G conditions, this tells me on a 10-year expected life of that frame, it will only get to about 3 2/3 life before it runs into major problems and you're probably going to have to be buying a new frame. It's beyond the crack point. It is now so destroyed, you can't go any further. That's a 2/3 of the life of the frame gone. This is a fatigue curve, typical structural fatigue curve. 1 million cycles at about 1.2 Gs. It's only 20% over our own weight throwing around. If you reduce this down to 500,000 cycles, we're only able to get 1.5 Gs. If I apply this again here, here's that rack G level. Again, another example, 3.85 years on this particular frame, it's only 9% rowing resistance. You start to see maybe there's a trend between rowing resistance and actual rack life. Well, you know something? If I reduce rack down to availability, a little bit different complex math in there, but essentially at the end of the day, I can show very easily between rowing resistance of the haul road and the actual availability on the truck. This now starts to make sense to maintenance guys. So for example, here, just over 5% rowing resistance, we're going to have a difference between actually having no rowing resistance and 5%, somewhere around 1.5, 1.25% loss in truck frame availability, structural availability. If I set out at this point, say, okay, I'm going to live with that, but I got my haul road sitting at 9% rowing resistance, that's a 4% loss. This literally is a 2.75% change in availability. You go from 9% down to 5% rowing resistance, you actually get back 2.75% availability. If anyone had said to me 10 years ago, Tim, if you build better haul roads, we can actually improve the availability of the truck, I'd say, you know, it makes sense, but I have no idea how to do it. There's some real hard data evidence here. I think this gives food for thought that if there was anything you wanted to look at, if you could improve your haul road quality and then just see how much availability you get back on your trucks, it'll become self-evident. Again, just applying that to different types of materials, approaching 95% availability for a limestone cap, a sand cap, we're less than 65% availability on those trucks. They're always in the shop running on those running surfaces. I thought I'd throw one more thing in here. And actually it's coincidental that Kent mentioned this as well. Essentially, fuel usage, in the oil sand, we sit around 6% rowing resistance. Our ground never gets down to those 2 and 3% that everyone would like to see. And we're seeing literally about 1,700 liters of fuel per shift being used per vehicle. In the fall, it jumps up, so this is where the ground starts to get firmer, or it starts to become softer, so going from winter to fall. So it's softer in the fall, about 1,800. In summer, we're about 2,200 liters per shift. And the only thing that's different here is summer is really soft ground conditions, winter very hard ground conditions. That is a reduction in rowing resistance. So reducing rowing resistance, or total resistance here, I've included grade, but rowing resistance down, this is the impact you get. Soft ground conditions, half fuel usage, and of course you have to have higher emissions, we'll talk about that in a second. But essentially you add on the gramp, if you found yourself above that 10%, you're talking about huge fuel usage. So if we can reduce our ramp grades, one thing, not always possible to do, but if we can get our rowing resistance down, I think it's very possible to do. Then I think there's a way in which we can actually save fuel. And this is the great kicker, I love this. So here we got a scale going up to about 25% total resistance. So this is the effective grade that Ken was talking about. Essentially, if we're seeing about 10% resistance, we're looking at about, 800 grams per hour of emissions of carbon monoxide. Or we're sending out into the atmosphere, if we're still at tier 2, tier 3 range, we're sending out about 1,400 grams per hour, not just NOx, but also hydrocarbons, unburnt fuel. Okay. So looking at this data here, and this was something that Derek Weston from RIMEX was saying to me at lunchtime, he said, did you see this notice from Australia, and also one now in Canada, where they want to reduce emissions by 30%, back to 2005 numbers by 2030. I think it was 2030 was in the news today. Well, you know something? You want to reduce these emissions by 30%. Let's look at the NOx one. You reduce this by one third. We can do that by reducing our rolling resistance by 2.5 to 3%. Well, hold on a second. Did we just hit on something? how do you, as companies, as mine operators, those that are in the room, how do you justify to the government you've actually reduced your emissions so you don't have to pay the fines and the penalties? If you could reduce your rolling resistance and get your fuel emissions down, doesn't that just get you into compliance? And I think that's something worth thinking about. So my conclusion is this, essentially, and this is a log scale, all the things I've talked about today are on this chart. This is a quick and dirty, take it away, use it as you will. I don't think there's anything here that a mine operator could not put into practice tomorrow, have some young engineer throw this at them and say, I want you to do this. All they need to pull off the trucks is the suspension pressure data. That's it. And the rest can be determined from that. Thank you very much.